Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram, the show where voices are amplified, truth is paramount, and the community drives the dialogue. This week, we reconnect with my friend, Dr. Howard Fuller. We examine the topic of charter schools. What exactly is a charter school? What distinguishes public education from private ones? How can we achieve equitable funding? Who is impacted by this in our community? Join us in the classroom and gain insight from the educator himself, Dr. Fuller. Be sure to follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy your podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Part three of, I think, one of the best conversations I've had with anyone as long as I've been doing radio and on the air, and as heartfelt and educational a conversation as I've ever had. And, you know, every word that comes out of the mouth of my guest is so important and hits home for me, and makes me think about the way I viewed education. I think back to, you know, the times as a young boy in public schools and in Milwaukee public schools, and even with my children as they were being educated. And I thought I knew something about education, but I realized that I only knew the surface of it, never knew the depth of it. And I think as many of you in the listening audience may feel the exact same way that I have. But I'll tell you something. Over the first two episodes and now here going into the third episode with the one and only Dr. Howard Fuller, I realize that I really need to focus even more than I ever did before on the importance of education and educating the American people, especially the children, because as we move, and this nation and this world continues to move towards a technological, a global technological reality, unless our children understand what education is, the importance of it, their futures are going to be very much diminished. It is with that backdrop that I welcome back the one and only Dr. Howard Fuller. Hey, good morning to you, brother. It's so great to see you and to have dialogue with you.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You know, Dr. Fuller, in our last episode, we talked about the origin of choice and the creation of it with you, State Representative Polly Williams and Larry Harwell, and many others, as you guys looked at what was going on in Milwaukee and education as a whole. And if you want to sum up a little bit for those who didn't know before we get into where we're headed this morning, the origin of, you know, charter schools.
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, thanks for that question, Earl. So I want to make sure that people understand sort of how I view all of this. And I want to put that out there as a sort of like an umbrella to focus in on the specific question that you asked. So It took me a while to really understand both philosophically and ideologically, you know, why I was doing exactly what I was doing. And so the foundation for what I do is my belief in the distinction between public education and the system that delivers it. So I believe that the Milwaukee Public Schools, for example, of which I had the honor and the privilege to be the superintendent from 91 to 95, I believe that MPS is not public education. It's a delivery system for public education. And so because I make this distinction between public education, which I think is an idea, and the various ways that you can deliver on that idea, things like charter schools, for example, or vouchers, which is not a school, it's just a financial scheme for getting people to a school. All of that operates for me under the umbrella of how do you educate the public. And so since I believe that you can have different types of delivery systems to try to educate the public, I don't see a contradiction between believing in a program that allows certain children to access private schools and my support for the Milwaukee public schools. I'm not one of these people who wants the Milwaukee public schools to fail. That's idiotic. If you really care about children, you don't want any entity where children are accessing an education not to be successful to prove a philosophical point. So even though people don't understand this, I remain and have always been a strong supporter of the Milwaukee public schools, but I don't think it should be the only delivery system for public education in the city of Milwaukee. So that's the broader construct that I operate from. But the specific question that you asked, Earl, charter schools actually started in Minnesota in 1991, is when the first charter school law was passed. And ironically, the notion of charter schools came initially from a man named Bud many, many years ago, but it was Al Shanker, who was the head of the American Federation of Teachers, that gave a speech in New York that mentioned the idea of charter schools. And then he went to Minnesota, and people like Ted Coldery and Joe Nathan and John Schroeder, and then ultimately Ember Rykoff Jung, who was the legislature who put the first charter school legislation before the Minnesota legislature. They were the ones who took this idea that Shanker mentioned, and then this man, Ted Coldery, who most people don't know, but who's one of the smartest people I've ever met, they came up with this idea of charter schools. So the first charter school law was passed like in 1990, 1991, which was 2 years after the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program was first passed. And if you read Ted's book and Ember's book too, the people give credit to Polly for influencing the development of charter schools, because there were people who wanted to create more options, but they didn't want it to be a private school option. They wanted it to be a traditional public school option. And that's how charter schools came into being. And I think the first law, and I was involved in this, obviously, and a lot of other people, the first law in Wisconsin, I think, was like 1992 or so, but it only allowed districts to create charter schools. And it wasn't, I think, until about 94 or maybe 96, I can't remember now, when the law was changed to allow for, in Milwaukee, for UWM, MATC,
the city of Milwaukee,
and MPS,
right,
to charter schools.
You know, Dr. Fuller, you, I always have my thinking hat on when I listen to you, and you talked about public schools and being a whole group of different schools teaching the public. That always existed because there were always private schools, right? I mean,
yeah, the issue, Earl, had never been choice, is who had it. And so the reality of it is that if you have money living in America, if you're honest, we got choice.
Right.
So if schools are not working for your kids and you got money, you can move to communities where they do work. You can put your kids in private schools, or you can get the most expensive tutoring on the planet, or you can do all three. The people who can't do that are low income and working class people. So the issue really was never about choice. It was about how do you help people who don't have resources have that power? You know, how do people who, you know, like I lived in Hillside, you know, project.
Absolutely.
So how do people living in Hillside, or how do people who don't have the kind of resources that a person like myself now has, how do you help those people access private schools or schools other than MPS? Because Earl, you know that there are families living in the city of Milwaukee who have three children. One child may go to King's Academy or St. Marcus or Destiny. Another one might go to HFCA or Milwaukee College Prep. And another one goes to Milwaukee Public Schools. The reality of it is that you have families out there that are accessing all of these different possibilities to educate their children. And so for me, the issue going forward into the future that folks are going to have to deal with is, how do you equalize funding? Because if you have a family of three children, one child goes to MPS, and they will have a per pupil allotment of $5,000 or $6,000 more than if another child that you have goes to a private school, or if another one of your children go to a charter school. So at some point in time, if this system that we've created is going to be maintained and sustained, this issue of how do you equalize funding is going to be fundamental going forward.
So let me ask you, because in Milwaukee Public Schools, they have something called non-instrumentality charter.
Yes, yes.
And I was never able to understand how they could, you know, on the one hand, not support private schools or charter schools, but then they have that group of schools inside of the district. And for people who don't know it, it means that non-instrumentality charter schools don't have to follow the same guidelines as the schools in Milwaukee Public Schools. How does that work?
Okay, so that's a very good question. And sometimes when we do stuff, you know, you scratch your head. Like, what does that even mean?
I know.
So the easiest way to understand this is to look at it this way. If you're an instrumentality charter school, it means that the employees of the school are employees of the district, and therefore the union contract applies. If you are a non-instrumentality charter school, it means that the people who work for that school, like a Milwaukee College Prep, for example, or the Hmong Peace Academy, the people who work at that school are employees of that school. They're not employees of the district, even though the district is their authorizer. And for budgetary purposes, the kids who go to Milwaukee College Prep or Hmong Peace Academy or Carmen, they're counted in the MPS student count when it comes to establishing the budget. So the difference really is, are you an employee of the school or an employee of the district? So for example, HFCA, Dr. Howard Fuller Collegiate Academy, is an independent charter. We initially were chartered by the city. We're now authorized by UWM. Those employees are employees of HFCA. The money from the state comes directly to our school, whereas Milwaukee College Prep, which is authorized by UWM, the money comes to the district, and then the district allocates the funds to Milwaukee College Prep. So it's a little bit complicated, but it's not all that complicated that it can't be understood.
So, Dr. Fuller, you and I talked about just how critically important it is that our nation, the wealthiest nation on earth, and yet we have young people and children who aren't being educated, how that makes no sense whatsoever. Do you believe that we are committed as we can be to educating our children in this country? Do you think we put them first?
First of all, I don't think we're committed to our children. so what I mean by that is I don't believe that the political structure writ large in this country really cares about our children in the way that we should. Because a country like this country, we should not have a significant number of our children in poverty. Because when we start thinking about schools, like you and I were talking offline, you can't talk about schools without talking about the other institutions that impact the children who come to the schools, right? So that when you start talking about, well, we got this problem with education, there are problems with education that have to do with what happens in the school. And then there are problems with education because of what happens to the kids before they ever get to the school. So for example, I've always said that kids who are hungry cannot learn. Children who face significant issues of abuse before they get to the school are gonna be impacted once they get to the school to learn. So everything about what is happening to our kids isn't a problem with the curriculum or the problem that our children are not being taught how to read, for example, although that is a significant problem that we should talk about. But what I'm saying, Earl, to go back to your original question, the issue isn't, do we care enough about our children to make sure that they're educated? The issue is, do we care enough about our children to make sure that they're not living in conditions that preclude for a significant number of them the ability to become educated? So I think we have to always look at the whole situation that impacts our children and ask ourselves, do you think that we have a country where the political structure writ large cares deeply about all of our children? And I would argue that we don't live in a country like that.
You know, Dr. Fuller, what kind of, you know, bothers me constantly when this kind of conversation is being had is hearing people say, well, it starts at home. And so they got to fix that at home. And my response is always, what do you mean they have to fix that at home? And what people are faced with today, Dr. Fuller, as you well know, you talked about growing up in the South, being born in the South, and then, you know, growing up and you know, certainly Hillside was not exactly a paradise. And the neighborhood and communities that we grew up in those 50s and 60s certainly weren't Mar-a-Lago. And yet it was a little more conducive to the times, and we could get through it more so than today. But if you look at what the communities that our families are growing up in the families themselves, you and your three schools can educate children, Dr. Fuller, and you do a great job of it. But once they leave you and go back to an environment that is not conducive to them retaining what it is you are educating them on, isn't that a problem?
Well, all of it is a problem, Earl. But I want to try to, you know, add some specificity to that.
Okay.
But the first thing I want to say is I appreciate what you said about our school, but we're not doing a great job. We're doing a good job. We got to get much better. I want everybody to be clear about this, right? That we have a lot of work to do to make sure that all of the kids who come to our school are getting the best education possible. And now that we're going to become a K through 12 school, you know, the hope is that by getting the kids beginning, you know, in kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, that we'll be able to do a better job. But it remains to be seen, right? Because a school is not a good school because it's a private school or a charter school or a traditional public school. We have good schools in all three of those categories and horrible schools in all three of those categories, right? So the reality of it is that schools that work have to work hard to make it work, given all the things that go on every day in a school. And as we said, given all the things that happen to kids before they get to the school. So my point is that while I'm proud of what we've accomplished at HFCA, I'm also honest in saying we got a lot of work to do in order to get much better. And I think that Rodney, who's the current CEO, and Michelle, who's the board chair, would agree with that. But having said that, the conversation that you and I have been having, Earl, about what is it that's happening with education is a conversation that doesn't begin and end with what is going on in the school. But we can look at the fact that, and you and I talked about this resiliency research, and that's research that I've studied over the years to try to understand how is it that kids who come out of the worst circumstances, how is it that some of them thrive? What happens to them other than what is inside themselves? And the research shows that kids who survive out of war-torn situations, horrible conditions, the one factor that seems to be constant is that they have some type of adult support structure that is constant in their lives. And that can be a coach, that can be a Bible studies teacher, that can be a teacher. But if you go look at it, you will see that those kids who thrive out of the worst of circumstances end up having some type of adult support at critical moments in their life. You and I were talking about the book, The Pack, which is a book about three young men in Newark who had a pact to become doctors. Two of them became doctors, one of them became a dentist. In fact, Lisa Frazier Page, who helped me with my book, worked with those three young men to write their book. But if you read the book, as I did, really carefully, you will see that at different points in time, in spite of the fact that they had a pact, it was the intervention of adults at critical moments in their lives that kept them on target for what it was that they were trying to do. So to sum up this part of the conversation, what I'm trying to argue, Earl, is that A, what happens to children before they ever get to the school is critical. But two, once they do get there, we have got to make sure that we have structures and processes that are set up to teach the kids who are there, not the kids that used to be there or the kids that we wish were there, but the kids who are actually there. And so the hard work of actually teaching children, we have to understand how hard that work is. Being a teacher is extremely difficult work, right? And we don't compensate teachers enough. We don't give them enough benefit, at least in my opinion, for the hard work that they do. So if we're going to improve education, we're going to have to look at what we do, you know, what our curriculum is, what our teaching methodology is, all of that. And I can talk about it in specific about reading. We've also got, though, at the same time, to work on making sure that kids have food, that kids have clothing, that kids have shelter. Like if you read Evicted, for example, which is one of the most powerful books you can read about what it is like to be poor and trying to find housing in the city of Milwaukee. you can't act like if a kid came home and all of their furniture and all of their clothes and stuff was out on the grass, that's not going to impact what happens to them the next day when they come to school. Or if kids are sleeping in a car, that's going to impact their ability to learn. So if we're not willing to attack those problems, Earl, and just say we're going to focus on the school, we're not likely to be successful for the vast majority of the kids.
Dr. Fuller, you just, again, every time you utter a sentence, my brain just goes into overload. You talk about the resiliency research, and you talk about the kids who've been touched by some other entity, some other person who helps change in the trajectory of their lives. But that's not the majority of the children. So what happens to the majority of the children who are facing these kinds of things and there is not a mentor who's able to help connect them and steer them into, you know, the right path?
There are going to be some other people out there who are going to steer them into another path.
Yes.
The reality
come
of
on.
Is, you know what I mean? Like, here's the thing I ask people. Why would someone who don't see that they have a stake in what some of us would call mainstream society, if they don't see themselves in it, see no possibilities of being successful in it, and somebody's out there whispering in their ear, hey, you know, if you do this,
right,
you can get there, and you see these dollars in my hand, why wouldn't they do that? Why, you know what I'm saying? It's fairly, not simple, but it's clear, Earl, that when you do this, if you go to any elementary school in the city of Milwaukee, and you go first grade, second grade, third grade, and read to them, for most of those kids, you're still going to see an excitement.
Yes.
About learning.
Yes.
Right? Those of us who've been in schools, I think you would agree with this.
No question.
It's about the fifth grade when you start seeing the light dim in their eyes, right? The passion for learning begins to dissipate. And one of the huge contradictions that we have in our society right now is the longer kids are in school, the more they lose, as a general statement, the more they lose this passion for learning. And so what it tells us is there are things going on within the school, and there are things that are going on outside of the school for the kids that we're talking about who don't have resources. You see that dimming begin to take place. And for those kids who, for whatever reason, are not rescued, I'm gonna use that word, you know that the pathway that they're gonna be on in life is gonna be extremely difficult. And many of those young people are gonna turn away from pursuing what people like you and me would think would be a positive pathway in life, and they're gonna go down these other pathways. That's just a fact. And so what I believe, and I ended up saying this in my book, and it was hard for me to admit this, but all the work I've been doing over all of these years, I have concluded that at best what I've been doing is I've been on a rescue mission. And the idea is to rescue as many kids as I can. But the work that I've done in education has not led to broad systemic change. Because you can't have broad systemic change in the educational institution by itself, and you're not going to look at any of these other institutions. And so what you end up doing is you're in there trying to, like, you know, give these kids as much as you possibly can in the hopes that it's going to impact their individual lives. And you hope that if you can impact their individual lives, it will impact the lives of the families that they're going to raise. But I'm no longer operating under the illusion that that represents systemic change. What that does is it represents the possibility of individual change that you hope will spread more broadly.
So, Dr. Fuller, 2 decades ago, a brother named Jawanza Kanjufu wrote a series of books called The Fourth Grade Failure Rate for Black Boys, or whatever, I forgot the title, something.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
So he was pointing to what you're talking about now, you know, a couple decades back. And yet, in the face of facts and all of this information that has been gathered and garnered, we still don't seem to be able to get that message across to the people who can make the changes necessary to address this. And the thing that has always been perplexing to me is that we're always quick to say, let's get more law enforcement, let's build more jails, and we're willing to put the money there as if you're somehow going to be able to house all of what's coming down the path if you don't address what is easier to address on the front side of it.
Yeah, I can't deny that, Earl. I mean, this is like a ongoing conversation, right? It's a conversation that people care about what it is that's going on in our community. We've been having that conversation forever and forever and forever, right? Because even when I was in graduate school in social work, there was a man called Frank Reisman, and he wrote a book or article, and it was called Dirty Workers, Earl. And what it meant was, he was making the argument that there's a whole group of workers in society, social workers, police officers, parole agents. He called them the dirty workers. And what he was saying is, their jobs was to do the dirty work. It was to keep them away from us.
Right.
It was like, we're going to accept that because of the way that our society operates, there's going to be this significant group of people who are going to have no stake in the society. And they're going to become criminals and predators and et cetera, right? So we got to have a whole group of people whose job is to keep them away from us, right? And so what happens is, when you have a society where you see the significant number of people who live in under circumstances that are so radically different from those of us who have resources, you gotta have a whole group of people who are out there trying to, quote, protect society, right? And you see, you know, police officers, social workers, all of these people who are dealing with people that many of us are saying, I don't care what happens, you just keep them away from us. What you and I believe is that the them is us.
Yes.
And that our job is not to, quote, keep them away from us. Our job is to make sure that them wants to be a part of us, but that we're giving them the tools that they need so they can be a part of us, so that there won't be no them and us. They'll just be us. And I believe that to those of us who much is given, much is required. And for those of us who are us, we have a responsibility to give what we can to make sure that those who don't have, that they will have what they need to be dignified human beings in this society. And I just believe that. And I really don't care what people think about the path that I choose to try to do this work, because you and I know the only way not to be criticized in this world is to do nothing.
Yes.
Right? Is to just do nothing. Because the moment you try to do something, there's going to be a group or individuals that are going to come at you. That's just the way this is, right? But if you see problems and you see things going on, if you have any ability to help, in my view of the world, you're required to try to do something.
You know, Dr. Fuller, you are 85 years young, and your energy...
84.
I'm sorry. I stand corrected. And so your energy level and your commitment to this is as amazing to me as anything. You get up every morning energized. It can't be easy. You've got three schools, hundreds and hundreds of families that you are working with, in success rates that are outstanding for what you've been doing, in and the dedication to, you know, build a different kind of reality as it relates to educating Black children. And you've been very, very successful at it. Do you ever get frustrated in the face of the work that you are doing, that keep hearing people say, well, what you're doing is taking money away from the public school districts, and you're taking the educators away and the masses of the children then? Because, again, these are the conversations that are being had, right, for those who don't know, like I didn't know, and the ignorance of not knowing the information that you're disseminating and sharing with us on these podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, you get frustrated because you see things and you're trying to make things happen, and things just don't happen like that. I mean, it takes like real work to try to get something done. And so, yeah, you get frustrated. And I'm a pessimist, right? I'm not a optimist.
I don't, neither am I.
But my pessimism doesn't stop me from trying to make things better, right? I mean, some people are pessimistic, they just go sit down. Yeah. I'm pessimistic, and I'm like, but I'm going to, you know,
You're going to work hard.
Yeah, I'm gonna keep working. And I understand that people are going to criticize me, and I don't, you know, at this stage in my life, bring it. I ain't never really care to a certain level anyway.
Yeah, you've been a fighter.
I care even less today.
Right.
I care even less today. But what I will say is this, and this is really important for me to explain to you, is that when I was growing up in Milwaukee, there was a man named Mr. Wesley Scott, who was the head of the Urban League. There were people like Mr. and Mrs. Starms. There were people like George Nash. There was a Dr. Atkinson,
yes,
who was a medical doctor who did my medical care free, because back then, Earl, like, I was one of those young people how the Black community would look at some of us and say, ah, that one right there, you know, he gonna be something,
right?
And people, you know, people would pour resources and energy like into you, right? And so as I was growing up and understanding this, I always said to myself, look, if you ever get to a point where you can be helpful, you owe it to the community based on what these people did for you to come back and try to do that same thing, right? I had no choice, Earl. I was required, you know, to do that. And what I'm trying to get people to see is, okay, if you don't like what I'm doing, just tell me what you're doing. In other words, you know, fine. You don't like this, you don't like that. Show me the work that you are doing and tell me why we both can't continue to do the work that we're doing. And one of the things, Earl, I would say to people who are listening to this, no matter what you may think about choice, you can think whatever you want to think, but here's the reality of it. My last day as superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools, there was 95,649 children in MPS. Today, there's somewhere around 53,000. The reality of it is, no matter what your thought process is, we have a different education ecosystem in 2025 than we had in 1995. All of these are our children. It doesn't matter what school they're going to, how they got to that school. They are all our children. And so, for example, this reading initiative that I am a part of, and I'm appreciative to the mayor for convening this meeting where he stood up and said, look, we're not going to try to basically, we're not going to talk about how kids got to a school. All of these kids are ours, all of them, whether in a private school, charter school, MPS. Fact of the matter is, a significant percentage of these children cannot read. And what we got to do is pursue a strategy that will give our teachers the tools that they need to be able to teach our kids how to read. And it doesn't matter whether they're in a private school, a charter school, or a traditional MPS school. We need to put our arms around all of our children. And so I get up every day committed to that cause, right? And, you know, like, while I'm humbled and proud that we have HFCA, what's happening in the Marvin Pratt School is important to me. You know, what's happening at Golden Meyer is important to me. What's happening at North Division, obviously, is important to me. But what I know, Earl, is we're going to have to make some extremely difficult decisions in our community because of certain things. For example, the elementary and secondary population in the city of Milwaukee between 2004 and 2023 dropped by 13%. Earl, we are expecting 20% fewer first graders in 2030. If you look at all of our schools, right now, Washington has some like 400 and some kids, or they did last year. North has 300. And Earl, we are going to have to make some real, real difficult decisions about, particularly on the North side, because years and years ago, you know, we were telling Black girls, y'all got to quit having all these babies.
Yes.
Well, they did. And now there's fewer kids. And so we're going to have to look at all of the educational institutions that we have and make some difficult, difficult decisions in order to be able to serve those children well. So there's just so much that has to be done. And I just feel like a person like myself has a responsibility for as long as I can to try to do something.
So, Dr. Fuller, so in Milwaukee Public Schools especially, when you know, it was built and expanded to address baby boomers. My parents had 13 children. And so we weren't the only ones with large families. Back in those days, our families were large. And so baby boomers had a lot of babies. So Milwaukee Public Schools at one point in time, I think when I was going there, had 110, 115, 120,000 students. And right, if you look now, as you stated, you look at some of the schools that Washington and my alma mater that was built to house 2,000 students, North Division. You look at Obama and you look at many of the other schools, you're right. They've only got 400 kids showing up at any given time for a facility that's built to house over 2,000. If you look at the administration and all of the people that go into maintaining that those buildings, the amount of money that's being spent is mindless to say that I can't shut these buildings down and right size a district. I've never been able to accept the fact that there are people who keep fighting to keep buildings open. I do get it on the north side of town because those are where the buildings are for the most part, where there aren't as many students going to those buildings. And it just so happens to coincide with the fact that it's believed that they're not getting the quality education. So on at those particular schools and buildings. So you're right. These are issues, Dr. Fuller, that have been kicked down the road over and over and over. And this has to be addressed. And you know, I'm thinking that now with the new superintendent there, and now that the, you know, the cover has been pulled off of what's been happening in the district, that we can begin to start addressing these issues.
It's going to be harder, but it's not just going to be on MPS. It's going to be on private schools and charter schools as well, because I'm concerned about some of the schools that are controlled by Black people. The declining student population with a significant per pupil difference, it's going to be hard to sustain those schools, right? And I'm just saying, it's not just MPS that's going to have to make very difficult decisions. There are going to be other individual schools on both the charter side and private school side that are also going to have to make very difficult decisions. But the point I'm trying to make here is we're at a moment in history where there's a broader political effort, at least from what I can see, that is tearing us apart, you know, in all kinds of different ways. One of the reasons that I pushed for the Reading Initiative was I was trying to find something that we could unite around as a community, right? Because to me, I believe that at a time when certain forces are ripping people apart, you have to try to find what is something that we can work on together as a community, right? You know, can we come together on this one thing? We can argue about all this other stuff, but can we do this? I think the fact that all of our children need to learn how to read is, in my view at least, a unifying force. And it's at this moment in time, we're gonna have to find other things that we can work together as a community, across racial lines, across class lines. Because if we don't do that, Earl, not only are we gonna be just torn asunder, our kids are gonna be even in worse shape than they are today. And we simply can't allow that.
You know, Dr. Fuller, as we begin to wrap up this episode, two things, and I want people to know that we'll be talking about more, especially in the next episode, and that's the Reading Initiative and what that is.
Right.
And because it's critically important. And the fact that when we're having this discussion and it's about private and you know, and charter, and we're focusing on Milwaukee, but charter is across the entire state and public is across the entire state. And there's a pushback, not just in the city of Milwaukee, but public education across the state. As I've heard and continue to hear, the same thing. There are people in different parts of the state who resent the fact that charter schools are open and the competition or so. But this is not just a Milwaukee issue, is it?
No, it's not just a Wisconsin issue.
Right.
it's also a national issue. But the thing is, or one of the most difficult things to confront is change. Because the reality of it is that a significant number of us support change as long as nothing changes. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I'm all for change as long as nothing changes. Or more important, I'm for change as long as it don't affect me. And the reality of it is that you can either stand here in 2025 and continue to make arguments that people made in 1989, or you can step back and say, we have a different reality today. Whether you like it or not, I believe in living in the world as it is, not the world that used to be or the world that we wish would be. I believe you have to look at what is, and you either have to figure out how is it that we're going to negotiate this in a way that works for the people that we're trying to help, or you just sit there and complain and complain and complain and keep talking about how it used to be. I'm a believer in confronting what is. I'm a believer in understanding that change takes place, and not all change that takes place is change that you're going to like. But you've got to figure out how, within the midst of that change, am I going to try to make a real difference for the people that I care about? I believe that that is true in education, but it's also true in other things that is currently happening in this world.
And Dr. Fuller, I will say this last word. I walked, you gave me a tour of your high school. And when I walked into your high school, brand new, spanking new, state of the art. And when I walked into your school, I walked into a different world. I walked into the future that is now. And I haven't been able to get that out of my mind. If every child could have that, to have an opportunity to be educated in the future and not in the past, man, we'd certainly have something. You've been able to present that to many young people. We need to do that on a broader scale.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But I want to make sure everybody understands that while my name is on that building and what we've been able to do at the middle school and what we're hopefully going to do at the elementary school, none of that would be possible without the support of many people in our community, white, black, Latino, people from around this country. You know, people don't realize that I have a friendship with the Walton, a lot of people do, but that I was close friends with John Walton and have maintained a friendship with Christy Walton, you know, his wife. There's a man out in California named Bill Obendorf who gave $5 million for us to start our school. You have the people in this community, whether it's the Keldners, whether it's Dig Abdu, and then obviously the work of Corey Nettles and Michelle and Thelma and Patty Gadoran. The point I'm trying to make here, Earl, is that while my name is on that school exists because of the generosity and the support of so many people in this community. And it's now only going to continue to exist because of people like Rodney Link and Maurice and the new generation of leaders that have to now carry that school forward.
Right.
Because as you know, Earl, one of the things that happens in our community a lot is that people hang on too long. You know, you know what I mean? And I'm not one of those people, right? And I'm so proud that we have a new generation of people that have taken over HFCA. And I'm out of it. I'm no longer on the board. I no longer have any formal relationship with the school. I'm here to support this next generation that is going to be trying to figure out how to serve our children.
Well, you cultivated it, Dr. Fuller, and you planted and watered the seed, and it certainly, you know, brought back great fruit. So thank you very much. Always a pleasure. And, you know, the next episode, we're going to talk about the Reading Initiative, the impact of that, and how you and the others who came up with that, what that means, because I've always, from the time I heard you say that there are educators who don't know how to teach reading to children, it just sent chills down my spine, because to think that educators can't teach reading, has reading itself changed?
No, reading hasn't changed. It's just the strategies that we've been using to try to teach reading. And I want to make sure people understand this is not a anti-teacher statement. It's just a reality that because of different decisions that have been made over a period of years, you have a significant number of teachers who are good people, but don't have the tools that they need in order to teach our kids how to read. So
we're going to delve into that further. Dr. Fuller, always a pleasure. May God bless and keep you until we meet again.
Okay, my brother. Thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you. Dr. Howard Fuller, the one and only Dr. Howard Fuller.